You know, when we look at something like a bridge or a massive ship, we just see structure, stability. It's solid, it's static, it's just there.
Right. It's dependable, it's built to last.
But today, we're going to look at that exact same piece of steel and see something completely different. We're not going to see a solid object. We're going to see a frozen record of a race.
A really high-stakes, violent race against temperature.
Exactly. It happens in seconds, but it determines whether that structure holds for 50 years or fails catastrophically.
And that's not being dramatic. In metallurgy, time literally is structure. The speed at which you cool something down changes what it actually is on an atomic level.
So for today's deep dive, we're looking at a classic piece of research from 1986.
Yeah, this one's a big deal. It was published in the Scandinavian Journal of Metallurgy.
By three researchers, Svensson, Gredoft, and Badesia.
And the paper is called An Analysis of Cooling Curves from the Fusion Zone of Steel Weld Deposits.
Okay, I know cooling curves might sound a little dry to some people.
A little, yeah. But this paper is really a detective story. It's about trying to solve a very expensive, very loud problem in the manufacturing world.
The problem being you have to, like, build things just to see if they work.
Exactly. Before this kind of modeling really took off, if you wanted to know if a specific welding voltage or wire chemistry would create a strong joint, you had to weld it.
And then cut it open?
Cut it open, polish it, stick it under a microscope.
Which is slow, expensive, and wastes a ton of material.
It's incredibly inefficient. So these researchers, they wanted to find a way to predict the future. They wanted to use math to see the microscopic structure of the steel without ever striking an arc.
But to get the math right, they had to do some truly wild experiments.
Oh, yeah.
And we are definitely going to get to the harpooning.
We have to.
Because, yes, that is the real technical term they used. But maybe let's start with the stakes. Why is the cooling curve the holy grail here?
Well, think about water. It's the classic analogy. You freeze water, it becomes ice. But if you were to freeze it instantly, I mean, truly instantly, the molecules wouldn't have time to arrange themselves into that perfect crystal lattice.
You'd get something amorphous, like glass.
Exactly. So the speed of cooling dictates the arrangement of the atoms. Now apply that to molten steel. You're taking a solid, turning it into a liquid pool at thousands of degrees, and then letting it freeze back.
And that transition is where everything happens.
The introduction to this paper makes it so clear. The way a weld cools has profound effects on its properties, its homogeneity, and the residual stress left inside.
And residual stress is kind of like tension that's trapped inside the metal.
That's a great way to put it. Imagine stretching a rubber band and then freezing it solid while it's stretched. That tension is locked in. It can cause cracks later on.
But the big thing for this paper is that the cooling rate decides which animals show up in the microstructure zoo.
I love that phrase, the microstructure zoo. And we are going to open those cages later. But first, we need to talk about how they even got the data for this.
Right, because usually you think of thermodynamics as, you know, chalkboard theory. Hmm. These guys got their hands dirty.
Very dirty. They needed to know the exact temperature drop inside the molten pool of a weld. Not on the surface, inside the liquid.
And you can't just stick a regular thermometer in there.
No, it would melt instantly. And you can't put the sensor there before you weld because the electric arc itself would just vaporize it.
So we have to catch it. Like in the act.
They do. They used a technique called harpooning.
Which is just the best name.
It's amazing. They built thermocouples temperature sensors out of platinum and platinum rhodium. Very expensive, very high temp materials. And they built a rig to plunge them directly into the weld puddle.
The timing on that must be insane.
It has to be split second. The paper says they plunged them at a 85 degree angle immediately after the arc passed.
So the welding torch moves by, leaving this pool of liquid fire. And thwack, you shoot the sensor in.
Right into the liquid tail of the puddle. Too early, the arc gets it. Too late, the metal's already solidifying and the sensor just breaks. You have to hit that perfect liquid window.
Wow. And they ran a whole series of tests. Two different kinds of welding, right?
Yep. Manual metal arc, that's stick welding, the one you picture with sparks flying, and then submerged arc welding.
Which is more of an automated process.
It is. The arc is buried under a layer of granular flux. It's cleaner, hotter, more efficient.
I love that they actually included the brand names in the paper. It makes it so real. ESMAA OK 48.0 for the manual and OK Autrid for the submerged arc.
It matters for reproducibility, you know. Anyone else could buy the exact same stuff and check their work.
And they changed everything. Current, voltage, speed, even the inner pass temperature.
Which is just how hot the plate still is from the last weld. They wanted every variable.
And all this data was recorded on a Philips PM9832 chart recorder.
The old school way.
I love it. No digital storage, just a pen tracing a line on a moving piece of paper. They were literally watching heat die in real time in ink.
And those ink traces on the paper, those are the cooling curves. That was the prize. That was the raw data they needed to go and fix the math.
Okay, let's get into that math. Or the physics of the heat. Because the paper says heat flow in welding is kind of weird. It's not 2D, but it's not quite 3D either.
It's a hybrid problem. On a really thin sheet, heat just flows out in two dimensions, like ripples on a pond.
Right.
But they were using 20 millimeter thick steel plates. That's thick, so the heat doesn't just go out, it also digs down. It flows in three dimensions.
Like a hemisphere of heat expanding into the block.
Roughly, yeah. And there was a standard textbook equation for this. It's equation 1A in the paper. It tries to calculate the cooling rate, or GHR.
Change in temperature over time.
Exactly. And it uses a few key things. The thermal conductivity of the steel, the energy input, and something called arc transfer efficiency.
Okay, arc transfer efficiency, that's how much of the electricity actually turns into heat in the metal.
You got it. And for the manual arc, they used an efficiency of 0.775. For the submerged arc, it was 0.95.
Whoa, that's a huge difference. 95% efficient.
Well, the submerged arc is covered by that flux blanket. It traps the heat. Stick welding is open to the air, so you lose almost a quarter of your energy just making sparks and light.
So they have the standard equation. They have the efficiency numbers. They plug it all in. And what happens?
It fails.
It didn't work.
They use the words found inadequate, which in scientific papers is pretty harsh. The standard theory just couldn't replicate the shape of the curves they got from the harpoons. It was too simple.
So what do? Just give up?
No, they hacked the math. This is the part I love. It shows how science actually works. They introduced a new version, equation 1B. It's similar, but they added two adjustable constants, Cedon-1-1 and Cesar-2.
So listening to an equation isn't easy. But the takeaway is that Cedon and Cesar-1 and the cetology are basically tuning knobs.
Perfect analogy. They're tuning knobs. They realized they couldn't perfectly derive it from first principles, so they empirically tuned the equation until the math matched the real-world data.
It made the math fit the ink traces.
Exactly. But here's the key part. They didn't care about the whole curve, from molten down to cold. They only cared about one specific window.
And that was 800 degrees Celsius down to 500 degrees Celsius.
The creation zone.
Why that range specifically?
Because that's where the magic happens. Above 800 degrees, the steel is something called austenite. It's a hot, uniform crystal structure. Nothing permanent has happened yet. But once you cross 800 and start dropping toward 500, the austenite becomes unstable. It has to transform.
It has to turn into something else.
And what it turns into depends entirely on how many seconds it spends in that 800 to 500 elevator shaft. That's the race we were talking about.
Okay, let's unpack that. Time to visit the microstructure zoo. What is the austenite turning into?
All right. The paper breaks it down beautifully. First up, you have allotriomorphic ferrite.
That's a mouthful.
It is. Allotriomorphic just means without a regular shape. This stuff is, let's call it the lazy ferrite. It likes to start growing right at the boundaries of the original austenite grains.
So if the grains are like tiles on a floor, this stuff grows in the grout lines.
Perfect. It starts at the edges. Next, you have Widmanstetten ferrite.
Sounds like a German count.
Named after one. This structure is much more aggressive. It also starts at the grain boundaries, but instead of hugging the wall, it shoots out these wedge-shaped plates directly into the middle of the grain.
So it's pushing its way in.
It grows by what they call a displacive mechanism. It's very organized. Think long spikes or needles.
Okay, so we got the wall huggers and the spikes. What else is in the zoo?
Deep inside the grain, you can get a acicular ferrite.
Acicular.
Okay. This is the one engineers usually love. It creates this beautiful basket weave structure of interlocking needles. It makes the steel incredibly tough. And it doesn't grow from the wall. It grows from tiny impurities, inclusions that are already trapped inside the grain.
So you have these three characters, the one that grows on the borders, the one that shoots spikes from the borders, and the one that grows from the inside out.
And they are all competing for space. The paper describes the austenite grains as space-filling hexagonal prisms, like a honeycomb. As you cool, the lazy allotriomorphic ferrite starts eating up the edges of the honeycomb. If you cool really slowly, it has time to eat almost everything.
It dominates. But if you speed up the cooling,
it doesn't have time. It gets stuck at the walls.
Yeah.
And that opens the door for the Widmanstetten plates to shoot out. The faster you cool, the more of the fine, spiky structures you get.
It's like a game of musical chairs. but the music is the temperature. When you hit 500 degrees, the music stops, and the structure is locked in forever.
That's it. And any bits left over become these other microphases, but the main properties come from that balance of ferrets.
So the team has the math to predict the cooling time, and they know who the creatures in the zoo are. How do they connect the two?
Well, to predict who wins the race, you need to know the size of the racetrack. And in metallurgy, that's the austenite grain size.
And the paper shows that the grain size isn't random. It actually depends on the chemistry of the steel.
Yes. Look at table 3 in the paper. They show that grain size is heavily influenced by carbon, silicon, and manganese, plus the heat input. They even developed a formula, equation 4, to calculate the size of the average crystal just from the chemical percentages.
That blew my mind. So if I just add a little more carbon to my welding wire, I'm changing the size of the crystals that form.
You are. Carbon tends to make grains smaller. And that matters because remember the wall-hugging ferret. It needs a wall to start on.
Right.
If you have lots of small grains, you have a ton of wall space. So you'll get a lot of that lazy ferret. If you have a few huge grains, you have less wall space. So the spiky Widmanstetten ferret has more room to grow.
So, okay, if I'm an engineer back in 1986, here's my workflow. Step 1, I look at my wire, I write down the chemistry. Step 2, I decide on my voltage and current.
Step 3, you use those inputs in equation 1B with the C1 and C2 constants to calculate the cooling curve. Step 4, you calculate the austenite grain size.
And then step 5, you can actually calculate the volume fraction of each type of ferret.
It's a recipe. You put in numbers, and out comes a prediction. This weld will be 40% allotriomorphic ferrite.
So the big question is, did it work?
Remarkably well. When they compared their calculated results against their actual experiments, they got a correlation coefficient of 0.9 for the allotriomorphic ferrite.
0.9 is extremely high for something as messy as welding.
It's huge. And it predicted the trends perfectly. For example, the model correctly showed that as you crank up the heat input, you get slower cooling, which gives that wall-hugging ferret more time to grow.
What? It wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
I'm looking at our notes, and the paper is very honest about scatter in the data.
Yes, and we have to be honest about that, too. If you look at the graphs in the paper, the data points don't all land perfectly on the line. The authors are very clear about this. They say that manual welding has human error.
The shaky hand factor.
Right. Tiny fluctuations in welding speed, changes in the arc length. Even the best welder isn't a robot. So the real-world cooling conditions can vary a bit from the pure model.
And the paper never claims to be a crystal ball. It says the goal is to rationalize the curves and predict trends.
Exactly. It provides a reasonable prediction. And in the real world of manufacturing, knowing the trend, knowing that if I turn this knob up, my microstructure will shift that way, is incredibly valuable. It lets you design the weld on paper before you ever strike an arc.
It's basically a simulator for welding.
It is, and it works. The model as a whole holds true, even if individual welds fluctuate a bit.
So let's bring this back to the so what for everyone listening.
Yeah.
Why does a 1986 metallurgy paper matter to us today?
It matters because it fundamentally changes how you see the built world around you. When you look at a skyscraper or a ship, you're not just seeing a solid object. You're seeing a frozen record.
A record of what?
A record of a thermal event. Every single weld on that structure is a scar that tells the story of a temperature race. And the strength of that joint depends entirely on who won the race between the different ferrites all those years ago.
It's like reading tree rings, but for steel.
That's a perfect way to put it. And this paper was so important because it gave us the code to read that record, and more importantly, to write it. It helped move welding from a kind of art form to a predictive science.
So those adjustable constants, the CW1 and CW2 tuning knobs, they're essentially a bridge.
They are. They're the bridge between the clean, perfect math of theoretical thermodynamics and the messy, chaotic, splashing reality of industrial welding.
That is a wild thought. We are just surrounded by frozen history.
And thanks to researchers like Svensson, Grithoft, and Fedatio, we don't just have to guess what that history looks like. We can calculate it.
From harpooning liquid metal to predicting hexagonal prisms, what a journey.
It really is.
I think that's a perfect place to leave it. Next time you see a piece of welded steel, remember what's inside. It's not just metal. It's a battlefield of crystals that fought for space while cooling down from 800 to 500 degrees.
And the cooling curve decided the winner.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll see you on the next one.